Hi, this is Lori, your host of Happiness Hangout, a space to come and elevate your happiness levels. You, me, and our guests will discuss and help you apply happiness to all aspects of your life, even if you're already happy. Get your daily boost of information to help you feel your best.
Glad to have you this fine Wednesday evening around the holiday time. Excited to be talking to a gentleman who has had a pretty amazing experience in life. And I think you all are going to enjoy hearing about his experience. So as we enter the holiday season, we get to talk with somebody who's gone through a major life transition and who has come out on the other side, learning so much in life, and hearing about his spiritual journey will hopefully enrich and enlighten your life. So his name is Kevin Hancock. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. He's the president of Hancock Lumber Company. It was established in 1948. Hancock Lumber operates 10 retail stores and 3 sawmills that are led by 460 employees. The company also grows trees on 12,000 acres of timberland in southern Maine. Hancock Lumber is a multi-year recipient of the Best Places to Work in Maine Award. The company is also a past recipient of the Maine Family Business of the Year Award, the Governor's Award for Business Excellence, and the MITC Exporter of the Year. Kevin is a past chairman of the National Lumber and Building Materials Dealers Association, as well as the Bridgeton Academy Board of Trustees. Kevin is a recipient of the Ed Muskie Access to Justice Award and Habitat for Humanity Spiritual Spirit of Humanity Award, the Boy Scouts of America Distinguished Citizen Award, and Timber Processing Magazine's Man of the Year. Now, he's also a frequent visitor to Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. In 2015, Kevin published a book about his experience with the Oglala Sioux Tribe entitled Not for Sale, Finding Center in the Land of Crazy Horse. His book won the National Indie Excellence Award, first place in leadership, and runner-up in the spiritual category. Kevin is an advocate of strengthening the voices of all individuals within a company or a community, such as Pine Ridge, through listening, empowering, and shared leadership. Kevin Hancock, thank you so much for being on the Happiness Hangout Show.
Lori, hello. I'm so glad you found me, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you so much. You know, I'm very intrigued with your story. Find the people who go through a lot in life really have something to teach us about, you know, about life, and people take what we hear from other people and we use it in the way we need to, and I like to bring that to the world. So I'm so happy that you could join us. So we're definitely going to discuss your book, which is, again, Not for Sale, Finding Center in the Land of Crazy Horse, and its lessons. But I'd like to give our listeners a little bit of background about you. So let's find out a bit of background about you. So you're a businessman from Maine, right? Tell us what happened to you that you find yourself in a reservation in South Dakota. What actually brought you there?
Well, that is a great question. It's actually the first sentence of my book. I was standing the day before Halloween 2012 at the Wounded Knee Massacre site, and an old jewelry maker pulled up and with a big smile said, "What brings you here?" And that's really the story that the book chronicles. It's one of those examples, Lori. We think we know where we're headed in life. We think we know what is coming our way, but we really don't. And for me, I had acquired a rare voice disorder back in 2010 called spasmodic dysphonia, which often makes speaking very difficult. And that disorder came on right at the peak of the national housing and mortgage market collapse. And so I found myself the CEO of a lumber company trying to help navigate that company through the collapse of the housing market without the consistent use of my voice. And it it took a real toll on me. It made me stop and think and listen and look inward and think differently about who I was, separate from my roles. It made me think differently about leadership. And when the dust settled in 2012, when the economy had stabilized, I'd happened to pick up a copy of National Geographic, and the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation was on the cover. And I read that article, and it's a bit hard to explain, but it was as if every spirit and character ever connected to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation story came out of that yellow magazine and hugged me, and I finished reading it. And with no more thought than this, I said to my wife, I'm going to go there. I want to see what modern-day life is like for the people that live there. This is the biggest, poorest Indian reservation on the Northern Plains, and one trip led to two. I've now since been there 10 times, and a journal I was keeping on that first trip turned into a book, a story that I wanted to share, and none of which did I see coming, Lori.
Well, yeah, because here you are, a business owner, trying to figure out how you're going to run your 10 retail stores. You've got a family business. You're trying to keep everything going. And probably the last thing plus your voice disorder, you probably had it's the last thing on your mind that, you know, what was I going to be doing, you know, after this? You're probably just dealing with your daily life. And so, you know, with that being said, the way it spoke to you and you said you were going, is extremely powerful because, you know, to go across the country like that, you're literally going across the country. Tell us more about Pine Ridge. Like, you know, you said you got there and someone said to you, what are you doing here? So obviously you just went and showed up. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, I did. After I'd read the article and decided I wanted to go see the reservation, I did go online and start searching for an initial friend or contact there who might host me or help show me around. And being from the lumber and building material industry and knowing that Pine Ridge has significant housing issues, the quality of housing is very poor, there's not enough housing, I decided to look at housing organizations at the reservation to see if I could get started that way and maybe if our company could help, which we did end up doing. We ended up supplying materials, donating materials to build a house, and I've helped other organizations there. But really, at the heart of it all, Lori, I was going there for myself. I just needed a quiet place where nobody really knew me, where I could regain my balance a bit and search for my voice on a literal level. But what I really came to realize is that was symbolic for a search that was underway on a spiritual level, really looking to connect more deeply with the kind of the essence of my own voice beyond the public roles and responsibilities that I had in my life.
Right. Well, once you got there and you decided that you wanted to help, your voice wasn't working properly at that time when you went there, correct?
No, it wasn't. It's always a little tricky to talk about this story when my voice is functioning fairly normally like it is right now. I get periodic Botox injections that don't cure the disorder, but Botox is a muscle relaxant. And when it works, it kind of numbs the whole system into a more relaxed state. And for a time, I can speak normally. But often, you know, my voice gets very weak and strained and broken, and it's hard even to push out just a few short sentences. And all that kind of combined, you know, it sounds so obvious in hindsight when you can't talk all the time. You listen. That was really the big thing that changed for me, Lori. I got really good at listening to others. And as I was sitting still and listening, I began to hear what I would call whispers. I began to kind of hear the voice of my own soul that I'd been a bit too busy or preoccupied to have stopped and taken the time to listen to prior to. So the loss of my voice was actually a bit of a blessing, as it turned out, the partial loss of my voice.
Wow. I mean, right there, that is so powerful. That just really hits me, because you're talking about being forced to listen when you have so many big decisions to make as president of a company. And here you are with a family and doing all these other things and winning these awards and trying to keep everybody employed. And there's so, so much. Talk about a jolt. Talk about a big jolt. We could not imagine what it would be like to lose our voice. So you gain this, you have this big epiphany about listening and how it changes your life. Now I can imagine, you know, as you're going through this and you begin to listen, I would imagine that the way that you run your life changes. So, for example, I would imagine that, you know, the way that you deal with your family, your employees, the way that you interact with the world is different now. If that's true, can you tell us how it changed maybe your leadership style, your dad's style, because you're a dad, you're a friend? How did it change your whole communication style? Even once you got your voice back, how did that lesson change your style?
Yeah, it had a dramatic impact, and I don't really take any credit or want to take any credit for discovering this. I really stumbled onto this by accident as a reaction or response to the voice disorder. So you just take a basic example. So I'm the you know, the quote unquote boss of our company, our organization, and people would come to me with a question or a problem. And because I wasn't going to be able to give a long or detailed answer, when someone would describe their problem to me, I started saying, geez, that does sound like a problem, or that is a great question. What do you think we should do about it? And having done this over and over again for a period of months, guess what I learned? What I learned is that people already knew. They had great answers already to what they might do or we might do. And so I ended up just listening to their answers and essentially then saying, well, that sounds great. Let's do that. And off that person would go with his or her own answer to his or her own problem. And I quickly saw that that was actually a much more powerful way to help people than to have come up with my own answer or given them an answer or given them a direction that had come for me. And I have taken that that beginning to really believe that there's a big opportunity in thinking differently about leadership, and that there's a lot of power in leaders actually doing less, saying less, and creating more space, more white space for all the other people on the team, in the family, in the tribe, to have their own voice, to own their own decisions, and to express their own ideas. And that the partial loss of my own voice, which I'd only thought of as a liability or a problem, was actually a bit of a blessing and a calling to strengthen the voices of others.
Wow, that is a great lesson to teach other people that aren't going to obviously lose their voice. And, you know, you are forced to do it and try it. And other people, you know, have to actually try it without having that dramatic of a situation. So, you know, that is a wonderful thing. And I would assume, you know, feel free to talk about, you know, what you call your tribe, your business, your family. How it sounds like, tell me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the way they reacted to it when you would say, you know what, you need to, not you need to, but help me think of the answer, or I know you know the answer, go with it. Were they shocked by that? Was it natural for them to just sort of be able to come up with the answer because they knew it? And did they really kind of take off and soar because they needed to sort of step up in the business?
Yeah, the idea really fit our culture. I mean, our company has always been an organization that really believes in the power of people and respects people. So this was a natural extension of that. And the organization really responded, very well and has kind of blossomed. You know, we've been working now, Lori, for over a half a decade on coming up with human resources systems designed to push power out from the center. Employee surveys, focus groups, huddles, feedback systems, sharing of information more broadly in real time, and restraint on the part of supervisors and managers designed to put more power in everybody's hands. And the simple idea, which is really quite exciting to me, is wouldn't an organization where everybody led be more powerful and effective and dynamic and valuable than a traditional organization where just a few people held all the cards, did all the talking, made all the decisions? And to take it one step further, as I began kind of looking around the world and from some indigenous wisdom that I was learning about at Pine Ridge that was matching what I was learning, I really came to believe that that here at the dawn of the Aquarian Age, the end of the Piscean Age, and the dawn of the Aquarian Age, that there's a dramatic opportunity for a rethinking of leadership. The Piscean Age, if you look at it big picture, was really about the single savior leader who spoke for everyone in the group. And this was really true whether it was a household or a church or a business or a government or a school. That single anointed leader was the voice. But I think today the reason why you're seeing so much kind of discomfort and angst and transition around the world and voter rebellions and all of these different things is that increasingly in the Aquarian Age, people want to have their own voice. They want to know their own truth and they want to speak their own truth. And that leadership in the Aquarian Age needs to respond to that. It needs to enable that. And if the hallmark of leadership in the Piscean Age was about overreaching, those who hold the power using it to the fullest, that the hallmark of leadership in the Aquarian Age may well be restraint, which is having the power but not using it. And not to go too long on this answer, but looking back at Pine Ridge, what I saw was a community that was overrun, conquered, colonized, and felt like they had lost their own voice. And the corporate governing center had really taken that from them. And so I found it so ironic that I was searching for my voice, thinking about these learnings in a community where nobody felt like they had a voice, in a community that felt completely marginalized and pushed to the side. It was all quite magical, actually, that it was unfolding all at once and that I could kind of see it in bits and pieces.
You know, it really is. So what I hear you saying here is that when you went to the community, are they being led by our government, and do they still have their own center of power within the tribe, or how is it working in terms of when you got there? Who had the power?
Right. So that's a great question, and it took me quite a bit of time traveling back and forth there, listening to people, learning about current life there, and learning about the old ways to put the pieces of the puzzle together. But let me start with before. So before the colonization and the conquest that was rolled up in Manifest Destiny and America's Western expansion in the second half of the 19th century, when the Plains tribes were free and powerful and self-sufficient and traveled where they pleased following the buffalo, pretty much all the power and responsibility in their society went to the individual, and the center, kind of the corporate governing center, was small, hard even to find. For example, the the great father, the president in Washington, would send negotiators out onto the plains to make treaties with the tribes, and the negotiators would show up and essentially say, take me to your leader. And nobody really knew what that meant, because surely, because they didn't think about leadership that way, that surely no one person spoke for everyone. But after the conquest and the colonization, and I don't use this word lightly, but the genocide and generations of working to quote-unquote remake Indians as white people, when today the Pine Ridge Reservation is statistically the poorest place in America, a lot of that power that had been celebrated and given to the individual had really been, call it what you will, beaten down or stolen or hidden. And today Pine Ridge is, you know, kind of one of the most government-centric or dependent places in America. And yet in their ancient rites and values, like the Vision Quest, in their indigenous wisdom, they're kind of still holding the keys to their own freedom or future, which I also came to believe was the path forward for not just them or me or Hancock Lumber, but possibly, as big an idea as this sounds, Lori, possibly for all of humanity, which is returning to turning away from all of the distractions of the external and taking a deep breath and looking within you once again to realize that as Joseph Campbell used to say, you are the truth you seek to know, looking within you for your own voice and source of strength and power and independence.
Well, you know, this is very intriguing, because obviously you're going through your own transition as you go from your life in Maine to going to experience the tribe in South Dakota. Are they, you know, and I want to get into the book too. I'm sure you'll answer a lot of these questions as we talk about the book, and maybe I'm jumping ahead, but my natural inclination is to ask you, are they in transition too? I mean, if they're very dependent on the government, yet they have their own answers inside them. They have their own ancient wisdom and tradition inside them. Do they continuously struggle back and forth with that? Or do you see them in a transition coming out of it the way you did?
Well, that's a great question. I think I do see them as a community in transition, and I see a lot of reasons to be hopeful or optimistic for the future of that reservation and the people that live there and others like it. But I do think it's a journey that's likely to take a long time, because the past wounds and injustices and the oppression and the mismanagement and the persecution have run so deep for so long that you don't just snap your finger and move away from it. I ended up doing quite a bit of research into oppressed or colonized communities around the world, and there are a lot of common traits or characteristics that surface, and breaking those patterns once they've been set in place is not a simple or quick process. But I've come to believe that that connectivity and awareness in and of itself are powerful acts, that part of the process of helping people forgive, not forget, but forgive, reconcile, let go, and move forward comes from dialogue and connectivity, where others from away simply take the time to be among them and to, you know, essentially say, I know you're here, I see you, I know what happened. It's awful what happened, but I see you, and I see the beauty that lives in all of you as humanity, you know, an equal part of humanity. And I think that when we all stick to our own tribe and our own busy lives, it's just really easy to judge and not know others. But when we take the time to cross boundaries and make connections, what really surfaces is that which unites us is much bigger and more powerful and beautiful than that which separates us. And it really makes me think about or long for a future in which we all come to see ourselves as part of a single human tribe sharing a single planet.
Now, when you and I'm asking little detail questions before we get into the book, but I'm very curious, when you came to help, quote unquote, were you accepted? How were you treated as you know, I know you went back and forth 6 different times too. How was the acceptance process, and did you feel accepted?
Yeah, so the people there that I've met, and I've met a lot of people there, are very warm and loving and friendly, and they're, as a general rule, more interested in your heart than your head. So when someone there has gotten to know me and I've gotten to know them and they've accepted me, a common thing someone there would say is essentially, I love you or I welcome you because I can see that you have a good heart. And I love that about that community. That being said, it is a bit of a difficult place to go because they've had such a multi-generational experience that they're really tired of, I think, by and large, of people going there to fix them, quote unquote, or change them, right, or remake them. But that wasn't what brought me there. And I actually go out of my way when I'm there to tell people that I come there because it's a place that strengthens me, and because they have a story and a history and a culture and a set of values that gives me strength, and that they have a lot to share with the world. And again, connecting tribes, connecting communities, breaking down barriers, I think is an obvious and critical next step for our planet. Because when we do get together, just as humans, you see how much you have in common, not how much you're different with people.
It would be very easy. It would be very easy for them not to accept you, especially, you know, coming in from an area that they don't know and they don't know you. I mean, that could be very easy for them. So we're talking with Kevin Hancock, Not For Sale, Finding Center in the Land of Crazy, Horse. And we're talking about his book. So let's get into the book a little bit. First of all, okay, so you had the experiences. You're going through the experiences. What brought you to the point of why you wanted to write a book about it?
Yeah, so I was keeping a journal, and I found that to be very therapeutic, especially when talking was a bit difficult because my throat didn't hurt when I wrote, and I was able to express myself kind of completely and freely and personally. And somewhere along the way, around the second trip or third trip to Pine Ridge, it dawned on me that what I thought was a journal was actually a book. And a story that I wanted to write and share that was unfolding in real time. And when I realized it was a book, it actually got a bit scary because I was being so transparent with my inward look at my own soul and how I wanted to kind of grow and develop and heal that, it kind of scared me. But I ended up sharing the book as I wrote it, and it ended up in turn really deeply connecting with a lot of readers who just came back and thanked me for kind of being so vulnerable and being willing to share and to essentially say time and time again, I've had the same fear, I've had the same thoughts, I've gone through, you know, similar soul searching periods in my life, and that really led me to believe, which became quite obvious once I thought about it, that's what it means to be human. You know, we're all here on a soul's journey, just looking to find our way, to find our own voice, if you will, but we're taught to kind of either push those things aside and sacrifice and just keep doing the things we're doing or not share those things. And I found opening up for me was very powerful. And for readers who were also in the process of opening up or wanting to open up, they found it quite powerful as well in many cases.
And, you know, tell us more about what the title means. You know, not for sale. What does that title mean?
Yeah, so I joke about it a little bit because sometimes people will look at the title and say that, oh, that's so nice, Kevin, your book is free. And then I feel bad and I have to say, no, the book's actually, you have to buy it. but the title has a dual meaning that was really important to me. One for the people of Pine Ridge and then one for myself. So for the people of Pine Ridge and the other reservations on the Northern Plains, in the 1930s, they began filing a series of lawsuits against the federal government for the taking of their land back in the second half of the 19th century. And as one might expect, their lawsuits were defeated and thrown out of court and so forth. But they didn't quit. And in 1980, they found themselves before the United States Supreme Court in a very famous case called the Sioux Nation of Indians versus the United States of America. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Sioux, saying that the United States government had violated their Fifth Amendment rights by taking their land without just compensation. And so then the court went back to the 1870s and calculated the value of the land at that time, compounded the interest to the present day, and awarded the Sioux something like $112 million, which, as an aside, is somewhat ridiculous because the territory we're talking about was like most of North Dakota, most of South Dakota, and a good part of Wyoming and Montana. But anyway, the Sioux came back to the podium and said, oh, your honors, I'm sorry, you don't understand, our land's not for sale. They had gone to court to get their land back, not to get paid for their land, and they would not and have not taken the money. And the money to the present day sits in trust, and it's now worth over $1 billion. So that's their part of the not for sale story. And then my part as a businessman was I, in the prime of his quote unquote prime of his career, as I came to realize that while I loved my role and I loved the company I was a part of, that wasn't who I was, and that I wanted to define myself in a broader, more balanced, more authentic and holistic way. And in that respect, I too was not for sale. And I kind of gave up that, what I call that business notion of global conquest in this 24/7 hard driving world of bigger, better, more, go, go, go. So that's the dual meaning of the title.
I see. And, you know, I did hear you mention the word vision quest before. What does vision quest mean? I mean, what is vision quest?
Yeah, so the Lakota have seven sacred rites that were brought to them long ago, as they tell the story, before even the coming of the horses by the white buffalo calf woman. And one of those rites was the vision quest rite. And in that right, young people coming of age or adults at a transformational moment in their lives would leave their tribe and journey out alone in the wilderness for the purpose of seeking a vision. The Lakota term is Hanblechia, which means to cry for a vision. And the idea was that seeking was the biggest part of the process of finding. The Lakota say the spirits will meet you halfway, but that by intentionally seeking to really look inward, gain a deeper understanding into the soul of who you were, what you were about, what excited you, made you light up, made you unique, that you could find your path, and then you were expected to come back to your tribe and live your life in accordance with that vision. And this goes back, Lori, to that whole idea of a culture or a community led by powerful individuals. Because what the right was really doing was strengthening the power of each individual's voice. And for me, it was right out of Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book. The strength of the pack is the wolf, and the notion that if every individual was strong and true to their voice, then by default, the entire tribe would be strong. So that's the Lakota vision quest, right? And over time, it occurred to me that I was on a bit of a modern-day vision quest myself, someone who was searching alone in the wilderness. So it came to have both an old and a modern meaning for me.
Well, sure. You know, I keep thinking of the term self-actualization. And we talk about, you know, in my world, I teach in counseling, we talk about being self-actualized and rising to the highest, best self in terms of personal growth and looking at the big picture of the world and knowing that it's just not us. We can see such a bigger picture. And it seems like the, you know, the American Indian always understood that. But, you know, sometimes our culture can get so wrapped up, and we know this, you know, in other things that we don't put time towards that. And I can tell you, I, you know, understand that to a point. I've never obviously gone and visited the way you have, but I understand that to a point of saying no to a career that wasn't in any way fulfilling and taking a deep breath and finding my passion. I mean, I think it's all the same. It's self-actualizing, self-fulfilling. When you get to that point, that is your best self. And it's interesting that the American Indian understood that, has always understood that.
Yes, well said, and I agree exactly. And it's it's really again looking inward for your own voice, waking up from the unconscious to the conscious self, and thinking about life as a soul's journey in which it's each soul's opportunity and responsibility to follow their own voice and to do that which makes you light up. And when you do those things that make you light up or lose track of time, that's invariably, I've come to believe, Lori, when you become the most valuable to others. And came to believe and wrote about in my book that done correctly, being selfish is selfless, because the number one thing we have to do to strengthen our ability to be of value to others is to take care of ourselves and make ourselves whole and alive and powerful and energized, which is easier said than done, and a bit of a never-ending process. It's kind of the process of living. But it all made me think differently about even, you know, being human and thinking about that more as a soul's journey than a physical journey, and the body even as being a bit of a vessel for the soul, and that each soul being on its own journey, seeking its own truth.
Well, you know, several of the things you just said are truly documented around the research of happiness. You know, in terms of, you know, finding passions, in terms of giving back to others, and in terms of, you know, endorphins being released and serotonin being released when you give back, when you show gratitude, when you do, you know, follow the path that you need to follow. So, I mean, several things, the way you said them, really fit to that. So it's, you know, it makes a lot of sense. So, you know, as you're trying to live your life, and here you are going back and forth, being helpful to them, which is empowering you and like you said, taking your soul's journey to another level. How do you find a way to go back and forth between, say, the business and what you have to do? You know, it's changed you, but you still have duties. You still have presidential, quote unquote, things you have to do. You still have to, you know, live in this culture and then go into another culture. How does one go back and forth and deal with that? How did that work for you?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it was a bit tricky at first, but what I came to, what I've come to really embrace is the idea of trying to bring a bit more of that soulful balance back into a modern organization. You know, we've got this model now in our world where if we're not careful, you spend a big chunk of your life working in one environment and then you go on vacation or retreat or weekend to escape and kind of embrace who you are. But that's certainly not optimal because we spend such a big part of our life at work. So what would actually be optimal is if we could bring a bit more of both worlds together. I talk about it now or think about it now as putting the work back in its place where it's important. We're committed, we're into it, we're enthusiastic, but it's not all consuming. And also trying to create a work environment, again, if you could create a work environment where every voice felt important and trusted and respected and heard, that in and of itself would make the nature of work more valuable and work could become a more powerful place where more people could grow and discover who they are and test themselves and learn and, so it's kind of integrating the two worlds. We've been living in a model where you spend most of your time in the work world and then you escape, but, it's not optimal, like I said, and I think there's a big opportunity to try to integrate the two so that, they're together, not separate.
Well, you know, I think our culture, and, you know, I'm speaking from Western culture, it's been a lot more open to follow your passion and to find the work you love. You'll make the money to survive and hopefully more than survive. And that you can't really separate those things. We tried that. We had a lot of unhappy people. We had a lot of people, you know, dying from disease and all these things are happening, and I think we're in a place where the spiritual part of it, whatever that means to a person, is coming alive, and that we'd be better off for it. Because I remember a gentleman I was talking to, I was reading in my happiness research, and what he started to do at his workplace is, no matter what was going on in his day, his mindset, he would say, how can I be of service or helpful to this person? He totally changed his mindset to think that way about everybody that he had to approach or that approached him. And it completely changed the way he worked. And I think there's still a lot of fear out there about, well, if you don't grind to the grind and you don't push that hard, you're not going to make the money. But it's been a long time said that relationships are everything, even in business. Relationships are everything. People want to buy, as they say in my networking group, from who they know, like, and trust. So I think it's starting to transition, and some people have it down better than others, and I know it's scary to do, but I'll tell you, it makes for a heck of a lot better life, I think. And I think, you know, your experience has been extremely powerful, but I think if people can get their mindsets changed a little bit, and I think we live in a time, Kevin, where there's so much transition to this, it's kind of exciting. But, you know, you're doing it, and I know I'm doing it, and people are doing it, but I still think there's a lot of fear around it.
No, I do too. I think that's really well said, and I love that. I love that idea. How can I be of service to that person? What a great little quote to put on a post-it note and just keep in front of you all day, because it changes the paradigm of how you would engage somebody. And that's lovely. It's lovely. But to what you said too, I think, it is a time of change, you know, that I've spent a bit of time studying, astrology, and we are somewhere on the cusp or the transition from the Piscean age to the Aquarian age. And, they're really different ages, but it takes a long time for the traditional order of one age to kind of recede or let go because everything wants to hold on to power or the way things are. And it is it's a bit of a messy period right now, I think, in human evolution and you know, in the evolution of the planet. But in that, like you said, I think you can see a lot of opportunity. You can look at it two ways. You can look at it as a very scary time, or you can look at it as a very exciting time. And I think you will see whichever you want to look for.
Well, that's so true with anybody. You'll take out of it the way you perceive it. And you can't control that. All you can do is put it out there. So with that being said, you know, as we begin to wrap up already, tell us about what you hope readers get from the book. Like, what are the key lessons that you hope readers take away? You know, what are your hopes for, you know, what the book does for the world?
Yeah, thank you. So I think a couple things come to mind. The first, and they're both really simple ideas, but I think they're worth contemplating. The first is that when you stop and think about it, we all come from a tribe. You know, we're all born into a moment in time, a home, a street, a community, a culture, and that tribe has dogma that pulls on us to think a certain way and do certain things. But each soul is here to individuate, to find, and to do that, though, you've got to find quiet, you've got to be intentional, and you've got to be willing to do what's a bit scary, and that is to stop and look inward. But the key to growth, despite all the external noise, is looking inward, finding your own voice, and daring to follow it. The other thing that I would say that I've thought a lot about and I wrote a lot about is that the boundaries that we think divide us are not real. So in my book, every time I left the reservation and drove from South Dakota into Wyoming, I would stop at the state line that said, "Welcome to Wyoming." And I'd have a big smile and a laugh out loud, and I'd take a picture of the sign because that is an artificial boundary. It's not real, if you will. It's a human construct. And we've carved up the world into all these different boundaries that are not real. At the end of the day, it's one planet. It's one tribe of people. And we all belong to the same tribe. Everything on this planet is made up of the same stardust. It's all related and connected. And I think if we can start seeing past the boundaries we've created, we can start envisioning a whole new set of possibilities for humanity.
Well, yes, and you know, it was more, you get yours, I'll take my piece, and you know, I need my stuff and you need yours, and it became very separated. And again, I do think we're trying to see things on a little bit more of a bigger picture, and some people do it better and some don't. So you know, as you've gotten feedback from readers, you know, what are some of the things people say to you about the book?
Well, I think people really, historically, first of all, I think people were really, had their eyes opened about this kind of difficult chapter in American history. You know, we've pushed to the side what happened to Native peoples on the way to creating a great nation here in this country, and that Columbus, that which we learned in kindergarten, Columbus didn't actually discover a new world. People already lived here. And so I think it's that truth, which we all know, but it pushed to the side, that people find revisiting that eye-opening. And then I just think it's the candor of someone willing to be vulnerable and to open up to their kind of personal fears and challenges and hopes and aspirations, that soul searching that we all do but are taught to keep to ourselves. And keeping it to ourselves only makes it scarier And I think opening up and being comfortable with the fact that that's part of being human is something else that that readers seem to appreciate when they have had a chance to read the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book is not for sale, Finding Center in the Land of Crazy Horse. It's Kevin Hancock. And Kevin, it has been a pleasure to have you on the show. Tell our readers how they can get the book.
So there are two simple ways to get it. The book's available on Amazon, so that's one great way to get it. But my favorite way is through the book's website, which is www.kevindhancock.com, kevindhancock.com. And on that website, simply using PayPal, you can buy the book for $20, free shipping, and I see and sign all those orders personally, so they're autographed, and you can communicate with me, and I love to meet and know the people that have bought or found the book or the story interesting. So that's the best way to find me.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for being on the Happiness Hangout. It has been such an interesting story, and you know, it's heartwarming, and it combines business with spirituality, which is a really a cool thing to do. And I think more people, you know, would find value in hearing about this. So, the show will be out on podcast, as most of my listeners listen through podcasts, and look forward to that. So again, Kevin Hancock, thank you so much for being on the Happiness Hangout.
Thanks so much for having me, Lori. I really appreciate the opportunity to, that you've given me to share my voice to your listeners. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd also like to thank our sponsors, AirServe of Mentor and AirServe of Strongsville, residential and commercial heating and cooling company in the Cleveland, Ohio area, veteran-owned and providing the best warranties and guarantees and best financing in the business. Go to www.airserve.com. Humanity Thriving Out Loud, read The Magic Happens magazine at www.themagichappensnow.com. If you want to find all my information, you can find all my articles on Your Tango and Huffington Post and what I've been up to and all the happiness resources over at my digital business card to find everything that you need to know about the Happiness Hangout at Lori, L-O-R-I, LoriPeters.123look.com. Check out my digital business card, LoriPeters.123look.com. Thanks, everybody, for joining us on the Happiness Hangout. See you in 2 weeks.
Hi, this is your host, Lori. Want to get more happiness? Check out all the free readings, activities, and my blog at my website. Want to learn how to deal with life's challenges from your positive core? Check out Empowering Yourself to Happiness class, done totally online. You can find it all at www.happinesshangout.net. www.happinesshangout.net. Come explore and feel better wherever you are. This is Lori Peters with the Happiness Hangout. I provide presentations on happiness and well-being to businesses, schools, and anyone involved in wellness and professional days. Check out tons of free resources and activities also at my website, www.happinesshangout.net. Feel better wherever you are. Help us grow the Happiness Hangout Show. Become a sponsor. Businesses and nonprofits, get your info out there to thousands of my listeners all over the world for just pennies. Individuals can also sponsor one or more shows, and you get a shout out to your favorite charity. Several packages available. Come see what you get and put out there what's important to you. Go to www.happinesshangout.com. happinesshangout.net. www.happinesshangout.net for more information.